It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. This morning, I want to tell you a story about a boy who loved hamsters. And at the end of the story, I want you to vote on something. So you have to listen, because at the end, I want you to pretend that you're part of a city council. You'll see what that means as the story goes on. And I want you to vote on something. You'll probably even figure out what I want you to vote on by the time we get to the end. But first, there was this boy who loved hamsters. He really loved hamsters. And he told his parents he loved hamsters, and he talked them into getting him hamsters. And his parents did two things. One of them was good, and one of them wasn't very smart. The first thing they did was they bought him a hamster and a cage and some food for it. That's good. The second thing they did that wasn't quite so smart is that they bought him two hamsters. And it wasn't so smart because two hamsters don't stay two hamsters for very long. They're very friendly animals. And before long, the boy didn't have two hamsters. He had 50 hamsters. They're very friendly animals. So he went to his parents and he said, "The problem is the cage is too small. I need a bigger cage so I can have more hamsters because I love hamsters." And his parents thought about it and decided, all right. So they got him a very big cage and started buying food in 5-pound bags. And he fed the hamsters faithfully every day, and soon there weren't 50 hamsters. There were 3,000 of them. Don't underestimate hamsters. And now they were out of the cages. They were out all over the house. They would wind up under your pillow at night. They'd be sitting in your pillow looking at you when you woke up, and some of them showed up in your cereal bowl where you were actually expecting Cheerios. So he said to his parents, "Well, the problem is that we need more cages and bigger ones. And we need to have a special place in the backyard where we can put all these cages for the hamsters." So for some reason, and you might think about how you would have voted, the parents decided, okay. And soon the whole backyard looked sort of like a tenement rising with hamster cages stacked everywhere and little roads between them. And the boy and his friends would wheel their wheelbarrow. They were now buying food in 25-pound bags. They'd wheel their wheelbarrow down these little cages and they'd throw food into all the hamster cages every day. Now, he couldn't really play with the hamsters anymore. There were way, way too many of them. And before long, there weren't 3,000. There were, 50,000. And now they were out of the cages, out of the yard. They were all over town. They were in everyone's house, turning up under everyone's pillow in the morning and in people's cereal bowls, which is not where they wanted them. Now the whole town is getting concerned, so they call a town council meeting. This is the first of two town council meetings they're going to call. You'll be at the second one. And the boy was ready for them, and he said, "The problem is," he said, "I understand how you don't want hamsters running all over town and through your houses and in your cereal bowls." And he said, "Of course not." He said, "The problem is what we need is to build a boat, a really big boat with several floors that we put out on the lake." And he said, "Then the hamsters can be on the boat." And he said, "I can go out there to feed the hamsters and to play with them. And then they won't be in the town." And for reasons no one wrote down, the town voted yes on this. And they built a boat, a huge boat, sort of like Noah's Ark, but bigger. Now the boy started buying food in 1,000-pound bags. And he bought a rowboat. And he and his friends would row out to the side of the boat, and they would shovel food up over the side. He really couldn't get on the boat to play with the hamsters anymore, because the more crowded they got, the meaner they got, and they'd bite. So it wasn't safe to go on the boat and play with the hamsters. But The boy was happy knowing they were there, all those hamsters, and every day he rode out and threw more shovelfuls of food. Now, even though no one could know how many hamsters there were, the people in town could get a pretty rough idea of how many there were as they watched the boat start sinking into the lake. And finally, one day, the boat sank all the way into the lake and took all the hamsters with it. Well, the boy was very upset. So another city council meeting was called. This is the one you're at. And the boy says, the problem is we need more boats and bigger boats. And he said, I've done research. And if we can just fire 500 school teachers and stop fixing roads so much and put three or four times as many kids in the classes, then we'll have the money to build the bigger boat so I can have the hamsters. And after all, hamsters are God's creatures, so we need to provide for them. And now the city council has to vote. So now it's your turn. If you're on the city council and you have to vote, how many would vote for getting more boats so there can be more hamsters? One? More? Two? All right. Good. And why? Why would you want more boats? Because there are too many hamsters and more boats will give them a place to live, right? Okay, good. How many would vote not to buy more boats? And you might vote over five? Five boats, okay. All right, that's good. Why would you vote not to buy more boats? You get flat tires if the roads weren't fixed. That's good. Why else?
We couldn't travel places
or go anywhere. Okay. Why else? Well, this is complex, isn't it? These are hard questions, and you will get to talk about these questions with your parents later today. It's sort of a little present that we can all give them. Thank you all for coming up. In the center of our service, in the center of our lives, let us make room for life's quieter sides. We may use these first moments for lighting candles of memory and hope, or just sitting quietly, remembering who you are and why you are here. Please join with me in a spirit of prayer. It is one thing to love pets, it's quite another to love humans. Pets can be easy. Cages, food, a little contact, they seem to take care of their own inner needs, whatever those may be. It can be like love with training wheels. But to love people, that can be so much harder. Food and safety are just the start, and there's the cherishing, the education, the day-to-day caring, character formation, years of working to help empower them, make them feel cherished like children of God, the sons and daughters of the universe and life's longing for itself. The caring, the cherishing seem to go all the way down to where and how they live, these people we love. We challenge them and forgive them. We empower them to find their own voice and then learn to respect them when their empowered opinions differ from our own. All our lives seem like do-it-yourself kits that need the active care of others to be assembled well. Others like family, friends, communities, and society. The web is woven wide and fine, and we lose our connection with it at our peril. It is a lot harder to love people than pets. Yet there is that web, and we are part of it if we will be. We reach out to help one another and finally realize that the hand we take can also take ours, can also help hold us together. We are, whether we like it or not, all in this together. Let us reach out to cherish others and pray they are reaching out to us as well. And let us make a safe place for them. It can be hard work to love humans. Yet few connections on earth can give us as much support and love as those cherishing and supportive contacts with all those others out there. All those others, our brothers and sisters in the infinite extended family of God, the intricate web of our universe, the warm loveliness of life's longing for itself expressed through us. We are very challenged. We are also, if we but realize it, so very blessed. Amen. Going to do something I've not really done before here, and that's give you a theological argument supporting both birth control and abortion. I'm doing this because, as a theologian, I think that the issues of birth control and abortion are, at their most fundamental issues, not issues of individual rights. As a minister, I don't think I'd back them if I thought there were no more to that in issues that involve life. I think they're theological issues. And I think that support for either side must ultimately be presented in some sort of a defensible and integrated, coherent theological argument. If the option of pro-choice is to be a religious option, eventually it will have to be argued that there are times and cases when God demands an abortion. Not just permits, not whines and screams, but closes his or her eyes to, but demands it. The fundamental position of both the Roman Catholic Church and the pro-life movement in general is that the most important of all the considerations is the brute fact of a single individual human life. Every single human life, simply by virtue of being a human life, is considered to be sacred at every stage of development, even at conception, and more sacred than any other consideration. It's the quantity of life that's being defended here, not the quality of that life. This is consistent historically through most of the Catholic Church's positions in history and through most consistent pro-life arguments too. This is how and why, for instance, a pope can stand in any large and desolate metropolis looking in the faces of thousands and millions of women and children who are born to beg, born to sell their bodies and their souls in order to stay alive, born to die of starvation and disease and always, always economic exploitation. This is how he can look at those people and tell them that it is a sin to practice birth control. Because the Bible and God command that we choose life, and the word life means individual human lives, every single one that we can breed. So birth control is seen as a sin against God and can't be permitted. Likewise with abortion. There was a great Christian thinker in the second century. I've never figured out why the pro-life movement hasn't used his slogans. I thought they were so good. A Christian giant of a thinker named Tertullian, who said 18 centuries ago, "That is a person which will be a person. You have the fruit already in the seed. And if it is to become a person, then from the start, that individual life has to be the sole focus of this God's concern. And either to actively stop conception from taking place, as birth control does, or to actively terminate the development of that zygote or that fetus into another human being, as abortion does, is seen as a sin because you have the fruit already in the seed. It's not going to become a cabbage or a pony. It's a human being from developing from the very instant of conception. And so to stop it is a sin that must be stopped at all costs. As a theologian might say, God demands it. This is why those who think of themselves as pro-life can have such zeal and such fervor and such a deep commitment to stopping what they see as a crime, not only against individual conceptions, but against God himself. Now let's look more closely at some of this. If one human life is good, two are better, and a million are better yet. And the 6 billion we have now on earth are miracles of life to be welcomed and cherished. But why stop at 6 billion? Why not 6 trillion? The question isn't when to stop population growth, but how it could ever be stopped. How could the Roman Catholic Church or pro-life people ever be in favor of birth control or abortion? No matter when it happens, the argument will be the same. People committed to the pro-life position will be called on to explain by what authority the new individual human lives are to be denied existence or terminated in their development. If an individual life in and of itself, completely removed from its context in human families and human societies, if it's always good, no matter how many children the mother has had, by what age, no matter how many are crowded into a single family's room, a family's life, or the squalor of inner-city ghettos, then how could anyone committed to pro-life ever argue for birth control or abortion? 6 billion in this argument is only the beginning. Even if there were 6 trillion people, it would still be terminating the development of an individual life, still be opposing our will and our values to God's. This is assuming that these people have this God business right in the first place. And I don't think they do. Now, many people would say, oh, for goodness sake, just leave God out of this. It's just so boring. They'd say God, after all, is only a projection used by churches and politicians to control people. It's a linguistic illusion. Just leave it out. But to do that is, for one thing, to make it impossible to have any kind of dialogue with people who insist that that's just the language it has to be discussed in. I think if the argument's to be made, it will have to be made through their language, their own kind of thinking, and it will have to be made as a theological argument, and I think it can be made that way. Now, this is such a complex topic, and every one of you knows this. Every one of you can think of some memory or some story connected with issues of birth control or abortion that would take this in 50 different directions, and they're all valid stories and valid points. So there are many things I just cannot talk about today. I can't talk, for instance, about our government's support of anti-abortion and anti-birth control policies that help guarantee that third world countries can never threaten us economically or militarily and will instead become breeding tanks for desperate, cheap, illiterate labor. That's worth a lot of books and sermons on its own. I can't talk about that. I can't talk about the semi-alternative of adoption and the fact that this becomes a strongly racial and ethnic issue immediately. As in this country, it may be true that healthy white middle-class babies are wanted for adoption, but not many black babies. or the fact that pushing powerless women to carry a baby, then give it up for adoption, is coming very close to turning poor women into breeding stock for more affluent people. And that, I think, cannot be morally defended. And I can't talk about the patriarchal agendas that lie behind both the conservative pro-lifers and the male-dominated Roman Catholic Church, where women have not in 20 centuries been able to become full people in their own right, and where forced breeding laws help to keep them in place. Or the fact that while conservative churches talk as though abortion were murder, no church recognizes either an abortion or a miscarriage as the death of a human being that demands a funeral or ritual blessings. As far as I know, no religion in history has. The behavior of the churches looks instead, then, like their abortion stance isn't pro-life as much as it is intended to keep women in their place as homemakers and breeders. All of these are powerful topics. I can't talk about any of them this morning. But you can think about them while you're talking with your children about those hamsters. You can think of many other important areas on the subject, any one of which would be worth 1,000 sermons, 100 books, and more than a few violent and bloody street fights. But I want to return to just the one very simple point of the theological argument that sometimes God demands both birth control and abortions. My model for this argument comes from the Roman Catholic Church, from one of the finest pieces of theological writing in the history of Christianity. It comes from a papal encyclical called the Rerum Novarum, written by Pope Leo XIII in 1891. I'll tell you a little side story about this. When I was in the doctoral program in theology and religion and science and that stuff, I took a two-quarter course, a 20-week seminar, from a professor who was so brilliant that everyone was attracted to him, even though he was maybe the angriest man I've ever met. An anger that was clinical at times. He had to take quarters off for medical treatment of his anger. I don't think I've ever been around anyone who could turn an entire atmosphere into someplace that felt unsafe instantly. But he was so brilliant that his seminars were always filled, as these were. So it was a tense 20 weeks where we read more than we read for any other professor, where the demands for discussion in class were higher and delivered with a lot more anger. He stormed out on our class one day and said we weren't being serious and he wouldn't put up with it. So it was a tough 20 weeks, but it was very good. The name of the course was A History of Christian Social Thought. And he pointed out that we'd do this chronologically, going from the first century through the 20th, and that we were looking for social thought, not self-absorbed thought, not thought about how souls can get right with God, not mystical thought, none of that thought, social thought. And we're looking for Christian social thought. Thought to change the world grounded in specifically Christian approaches to life. And then he said, the question for you all for the next 20 weeks is whether there's ever been any. We read a lot. It's where I read Tertullian. And after the first 10-week quarter was over, we were all depressed because we hadn't found any. Pretty rare. Then we found a book written in the 1600s that was superb. I can't remember the name of it, but neither could anyone else, because, as he said, nobody ever read it. No one even knows what happened to the author. Some suspect he was murdered for writing it. But the book survived in a library, and 100 years later, somebody discovered it and said, wow, this is good. So it sort of entered the bibliography, though it really never changed anything in the world. Well, this was momentarily exciting and then even more depressing. It wasn't until we got to this 30-page essay written in 1891 that everyone in the seminar, there were over 20 of us in this very popular seminar, every one of us was just blown away by this. And the professor, it's the only time I really ever saw him get overcome by any emotion other than anger. And he was near tears as he told us that this little essay showed that the wise and informed pen could indeed be mightier than the sword. He said this essay created and supported workers' unions all over the world, and it ended child labor laws in many countries of the world. And then he got a little teary-eyed, which made him even angrier. And he said, this is the essay that helped my father be released from the coal mines at the age of 8. It's a powerful piece. The church knows it's one of the best things they've ever done. They've reissued it in commemorative anniversary editions at least 3 times. In 1931, 1961, and 1991. Sort of updating the translations from Latin to make them a little more modern. As other students of political science or labor movements know, this really is one of the most important essays written in Christian history. For 19 centuries, the Roman Catholic Church had not really cared, judging by their political actions, about the fact that people at the bottom of the economic ladder have always been paid just enough to keep them alive, as they still are. In fact, over and over again, the same passage from the Bible had been used by the church and other churches to justify this state of affairs. Some of you will have heard this. It was the passage from Genesis, after Adam and Eve had been thrown out of the Garden of Eden for being curious, when God told Adam, by the sweat of your brow you shall live. I'm sure he said it just that angry, like my professor. And so the church would repeat, life's hard, but that's the way God planned it. Suck it up. That's a rough translation from Latin. What Pope Leo XIII did in 1891, that was really so stunning, I think, was to use the same Bible passage to justify the opposite position and to lay the foundation for workers' unions and efforts to stop child labor throughout the world. And he did it simply by emphasizing a different word in the sentence. This is pretty clever. By the sweat of your brow, he said, you shall live. And what, he asked, does it mean to live? Does it mean merely to exist? To subsist at starvation levels? Does it mean to live like lower animals do, or maybe rats and cockroaches? Are we promised by this God of life, by this God of the Bible, only the absolute lowest possible quality of life? Is the mere quantity of life, the mere fact that we still breathe, all that religion offers? Is it, to keep it in the language of theism, all that God demands? The absolute minimum quality of life, no matter how nasty, brutal, and short? Is it only about how many are alive rather than how much they are alive? Is it like the story of the boy who loved hamsters, but now without even bothering to feed them or provide them with a place to live? Is that all God demands? No, said the Pope. It's not like the life of a lower animal, which this God of life demands for us. It's the life of a human being, and not the absolute minimal life of a human being either. Only an absolute minimal God would want that. Pope Leo's God demanded that our labors enable us to live fully, to realize the full potential of human beings. That means time for education, time for leisure, time for relaxation with friends and family, time not only to bear life like a burden, but also to enjoy it, to live it like a gift, like free and empowered human beings. Leo contrasted humans with lower animals, which he called brutes. Hear this remarkable Pope's words as he describes the brute. The brute has no power of self-direction, but is governed by two chief instincts. These instincts are self-preservation and the propagation of the species. But with humans, it is very different. It's the mind and the reason, which is the chief thing in us who are human beings. It's this which makes human beings human and distinguishes them essentially and completely from the brute. And what then is the role of the church in all this? The Pope says, its desire is that the poor, for example, should rise above poverty and wretchedness and should better their condition in life, and for this it strives. And then if conditions existed which robbed humans of this possibility of living like humans rather than brutes, if people found themselves in, quote, conditions that were repugnant to their dignity as human beings, if health were endangered by excessive labor or by work unsuited to sex or age, in these cases there can be no question that within certain limits it would be right to call in the help and authority of the law to do what is required for the remedy of the evil and the removal of the danger. And why? Why must the church do these things? Because God demands it. God demands it because humans must be given living conditions which allow them to develop fully to the limits of their potential as educated, intelligent, creative, loving, and joyful people. It is for that they were created by the God of life, and conditions which make that impossible are not merely wrong, they are evil. They are anti-life. It's a powerful statement. Each creature, he says, must be allowed to live to the fullest extent possible for that kind of creature. And you can get a dependable idea of what's possible for it by looking at what these creatures have done under ideal conditions. And when you've understood the fullest potential of a species, you have understood what, in theological terms, is God's will for that creature. That's what theology means when it talks in those very funny ways. Then when conditions within our control keep a person from ever growing into their full potential, then the church and all people with religious sensitivities must try to remove those conditions. And why? Because God demands it. Put it in ordinary language, if you care about serving the highest ideals you can articulate, those ideals demand that you obey them. You either take them seriously or you take them superficially. God demands it. I've mixed ordinary language and theological jargon, but I know you understand what I'm trying to say. This essay, written 117 years ago, changed the position of the church, a position which it had held and enforced for 19 centuries. Even traditions which have existed since the beginning of a religion can be changed as our understanding of, in theological language, what God demands of us grows. Now we can bring this full circle. Times have changed. The population of the world has increased almost exponentially since 1891, even more so since the era when the Bible was written. The deadly effect of overpopulation and undereducation and underempowerment on the possibility of living like human beings has never existed the way it does today. The pressures on single mothers and working families without the support of large extended families or social support has never been this consistently brutal. Neither the religious scriptures of the West nor established theological traditions have addressed this well yet, but they have to. And both the fact and the threat of more births and of more human beings is now among the chief conditions that make it impossible for many, many people, both mothers and children, ever to have the chance of living like empowered, cherished children of God. They'll be driven instead, as Pope Leo said, of the brutes by two instincts, self-preservation and more breeding, and of course, they'll be used for economic exploitation. They'll make our sweatshirts and our tennis shoes. Would you like to see what it looks like when human beings live only like animals, driven only by self-preservation and propagation of the species? Go to Mexico City, go to South Chicago, go to Detroit or New York City. Go to the ghettos, the slums, the shanty towns of the world, and you will see the evil conditions and the results of those evil conditions. You want to see it up close, one-on-one? Look at teenage girls pregnant with their second or third child, trapped in a system from which neither they nor their children are ever likely to escape. Nor are there many kinds of employment open to these women. What would they do? They can be prostitutes, and their boyfriends can be pimps or drug pushers or drug takers or criminals or exploited laborers living at the edge of starvation and kept there by a system which can demand from them what it chooses and give them no more than it must. This is the world we're living in, and we all know this. We're wearing clothes made in this world, and we know this too. The church's desire, wrote Pope Leo, is that the poor should rise above poverty and wretchedness and should better their condition in life, and for this it strives. And if conditions arise that are repugnant to their dignity as human beings, if health were endangered by excessive labor or by work unsuited to sex or age, in these cases there can be no question, he said, that within certain limits it would be right to call in the help and authority of the law to do what is required for the remedy of the evil or the removal of the danger. By the very reasoning which the Roman Catholic Church itself has used in its most famous and powerful document for social change, the grotesque overpopulation in many parts of the world, both on micro and macro scales, is an evil which must be opposed because it is anti-life and it is unholy. It is destroying even the possibility that the overwhelming majority of these people will ever rise above the level of brutes and become full, cherished, empowered human beings. And this applies first to the people we already have, not those who aren't yet born. If we can't cherish and empower the most fragile people we already have, and so often that means teenage girls and single mothers, we have no moral right to bring more into that setting. We have no more right than the boy who said he loved hamsters to bring any more lives into a world we have refused to make safe, humane, and empowering for them. It is perhaps the first time in history that those who want to defend their position as religious must begin to recognize that both birth control and abortion are not the enemies of religion, but are among its friends. Birth control is not just an economic necessity today, but a religious one as well. God demands it, because people cannot live like human beings in the squalor of the slums and shanty towns in which they will forever be defined like brutes by the basic animal instincts of self-preservation and breeding and, of course, economic exploitation. And when sex education doesn't exist, when birth control fails, when the only hope left for a woman, a family, a ghetto, a city, or a world is an abortion, when an abortion is the only means left of removing a condition which threatens to return this human or these humans to the level of mere brutes, then the church, the state, and all who are really pro-life and commanded by the highest ideals we can articulate must, by God, not only condone the abortions but help people to get them safely and easily. God demands it. The world doesn't need more people. It's already overpopulated. Breeding isn't a high calling. And it can't be allowed to trump the truly high callings we have of nurturing, educating, cherishing, and empowering the life that we bring forth. That boy did not love hamsters. He only loved the idea of hamsters. He didn't love real ones, because you don't put creatures you love into a miserable, crowded, filthy ghetto and keep them prisoners until they die. That's abuse, not love. Love demands that we stop bringing forth so much life that we can't cherish and empower it. Grown-up love demands that. Grown-up concepts of God demand it. Amen.